This is Jim Inkster. On this date 50 years ago, Charles Manson ordered members of his family to go to the house in Bel Air of Sharon Tate. A few hours later in Los Angeles, the word was out that five people here were dead, including the actress, wife of Roman Polanski. The prosecutor, Vincent Bugliosi, spent time with us 5 years ago on this date and remembered what happened on that fateful date, August 9, 1969. Here's how Vincent Bugliosi described it 45 years after the Tate murders.
Morning, Jim. It's always a pleasure being on your show. You're unquestionably one of the top radio talk show hosts in the entire country, and so I'm happy to be on your show again.
Why are we so fascinated with what happened in California on that night 4.5 decades ago?
Well, Jim, I think there are many reasons why people continue to be fascinated by this case, not just in the United States, but around the world, actually. If I were to single out one reason above all the others, and there are so many, and I can touch on a lot of them, it's probably because it's the most bizarre mass murder case in the recorded annals of American crime. And for whatever reason, Jim, people tend to be fascinated by things that are strange and bizarre. If these murders had never happened and someone had written a fiction novel with the same set of facts and circumstances, you'd probably put it down after a couple pages because, as I understand it, to be good fiction, it's got to be somewhat believable. And this is just too far out. You know, we're talking about the bottomless pit in the desert. We're talking about the Bible. We're talking about the Beatles. We're talking about the motive to ignite a war between blacks and whites. At the murder scene, they print words from Beatles songs, mind you, in blood. Who are the killers? Kids from average American homes with fairly good backgrounds, totally different from what we would expect of mass murderers. We also have the fact that these people may have murdered, Jim, as many as 35 people. At least that's the number that they use. Manson's been convicted of 9 murders. But the family, that was his group, used to say we offed, O-F-F-E-D, 35 people. They already had plans, and this all adds into the bizarreness of it. They already had plans to murder people like Frank Sinatra, Liz Taylor, Richard Burton, Steve McQueen, Tom Jones. The tremendous brutality of the murders, although we've had murders even more brutal than the Manson murders, but when you combine it with everything else, it makes it just unbelievable. There were 169 stab wounds and 7 gunshot wounds and 2 nights of murder. You know, the first night the Tate murders, the next night the LaBianca murders. And I think we have to add something here as to why we're still talking about this case. The very name Manson, Jim, has become almost a metaphor for evil. And that has catapulted him to almost mythological proportions. He's come to represent the dark and malignant side of humanity, and for whatever reason, again, people seem to be fascinated by pure, unalloyed evil. Evil has its allure. Witness the continuing fascination with Hitler, who incidentally was Manson's biggest hero. But Hitler, Jack the Ripper, Manson. Let me give you one example of Manson's name being used as a metaphor, and it comes up constantly, radio, TV, newspapers, everything. But I'll just give you one example. Mike Tyson was reapplying for a boxing license in Nevada, and he said, listen, I'm a bad guy, but I'm not Charles Manson. Also, there are the sociological implications of this murder. Most murders don't have any implications beyond the horrible act. Not so with the Manson case. It took place during the so-called decade of love, the 1960s, and Joan Didion, you probably heard of her in her memoirs, The White Album, she said that many people believe that the so-called decade of love came to an end abruptly on the night of August the 9th, 1969. ABC's Diane Sawyer said something changed in the heart of America with the Manson murders. You see, Jim, going all the way back, prior to the Manson murders, hippies were not associated with violence and murder. They were associated with drugs, free love, peace, etc. And the Manson family comes along looking like hippies, living like hippies. But as you know, Jim, they were mass murderers. That was their religion, their cradle. They wanted to kill as many people as they could. And that shocked America, particularly when Americans found out who these young kids were from average American homes. There was a sense that they could have been the children of any parents in America.
Do you find a curiosity or an irony in that you were born August 1934, and a few months later, Charlie Manson was born, both sons of the Midwest, and then you converge in Los Angeles, obviously, on two different missions?
Yeah, other people have noticed that irony, and respect is probably a bad word because it connotes something good. We both acknowledged the other or respected the other. I respected him as a heavyweight in the world of crime, if you can call that respect. And he, from the witness stand, said that that I was a genius. So I think he deliberately got other people to do his bidding for him, so he thought he would immunize himself from criminal responsibility. And as it turned out, it was much more difficult convicting him since he did not participate in these murders. And to this day, he's saying, I didn't kill anybody. And he didn't. I didn't kill anybody. How can you put me behind bars when I didn't kill anybody? Well, if you're a part of a conspiracy to commit a crime, each member of the conspiracy, and here Manson was the architect of the conspiracy, each member is criminally responsible for all acts committed by their co-conspirators. He's the one that ordered and masterminded these murders. But he's still bleeding out, or whatever the word is, I didn't kill anybody. Well, I've never said he did. Well, he did participate in other crimes. At least one other murderer that we know about tried to kill someone else, thought he had killed them, and saw them at the county jail walking, and he did a double take because he thought the guy was dead. But no, he didn't kill anybody, but he's responsible for those murders.
Vincent Bugliosi is the guest, the author of Helter Skelter. That term, of course, became part of the American lexicon after you wrote the best-selling book.
As you know, it became the biggest-selling best true crime book in publishing history. In Cold Blood is number two.
How did you get on the case?
Well, I was assigned the case. You know, I was assigned the case, and you have to realize, I don't want to boast, but you have to realize that if you've got a big case like this, the DA doesn't just put his hand into a hat and pull out a name. I had risen, was considered to be the top prosecutor in the office. I'd only been in the office for 5 years. Usually a case like this, a big case, is considered a plum, a prosecutorial plum, and it's given to prosecutors who have been in the office for 20, 25 years. Like the Sirhan case, there were three prosecutors on that case, all of whom had more than 20 years' experience. But for whatever reason, I rose to the top of the office. At the end of only about three and a half years, there was already a series, a Jack Webb TV series called The DA, and actor Robert Conrad patterned his role after me, followed me around the courts, and came to the home. His favorite dinner was my wife's stew. So I don't know. I guess for whatever reason, I rose to the top of the office. I think it was the London Times said that the L.A. DA's office threw its heaviest gun at Manson.
But did you know much about the case when you were assigned to it?
I was assigned to this case, not immediately. I was assigned the first moment that the Manson family became suspects. Before that, I knew about the case. I mean, it was a story on page one. It was a front page story. And no one knew who the Manson, not the Manson, no one knew who the Tate LaBianca killers were. But it was a huge, huge story. There were people coming back from Europe saying that the Manson case was a bigger story over there than Chappaquiddick was. And we all know about Chappaquiddick. One reason, of course, is that Sharon Tate's, one of the victims, her husband was Roman Polanski, a pretty famous director. One of the victims, Wojciech Frykowski, was from Poland. But it was a huge, huge case. The world media covered it. It was the biggest case that the LADA's office had ever had up to that point. Since that time, there's been the Simpson case, which in terms of publicity was even bigger than the Manson case.
Well, in that half month that you speak of, Ted Kennedy was in a car accident in which Mary Jo Kopechne died. A man, Neil Armstrong, landed on the moon. And then we have the Manson killings. And it's
and
hard.
Woodstock, too,
and,
I think.
And Woodstock as well. You're right. And it's
yeah,
hard.
It's incredible, that summer of 69, yeah.
It's hard to find a more sympathetic victim than Sharon Tate, one of the most beautiful women ever, and she was 8 months pregnant.
8.5 months pregnant, right. And she told Susan Atkins, although Susan Atkins has since refused to say it on the witness stand, but she said, please let me live so I can have my baby. And Susan Atkins told me when she was cooperating, and then she went back to her god, Charles Manson, and I couldn't use anything she said. But she said, she told me, I told her, look, bitch, I don't have any mercy on you. You're going to die, you know. And poor Sharon's mother, Doris, she's dead now. She told me more than once, she said, every day I hear and I see Sharon begging for her life to have her baby. Sharon had a baby bassinet in her room, freshly wrapped in cellophane. It was on top of an armoire so she could look at it. She was just living to have that child. She stopped drinking coffee and everything. And, yeah, she was brutally murdered, 16 stab wounds. When I was mentioning all the things that add up to the bizarreness of it, the victims were not huge, but, I mean, Sharon Tate was on the threshold of stardom. Abigail Folger was the heiress to the coffee forge fortune. And then there was the internationally famous hairstylist, Sebring. When you add everything up, it was just something that would not make good fiction.
We will return with more Talk Louisiana after this brief timeout and hear more from Vincent Bugliosi, who died in 2015, shortly after the 45th anniversary of the Tate murders. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we're playing an encore interview 5 years ago with Vincent Bugliosi. He died in 2015, not long after this interview was conducted. The man who wrote the bestseller Helter Skelter became famous, not as famous as Charlie Manson, but well-known himself for prosecuting Manson and his family for the deaths of Sharon Tate and four other people. We talked with him about the place that this occurred, Paradise. How could it happen here?
It was an expensive home, secluded at the top of a long, winding road. Bel Air is one of the most expensive areas in the entire country, and they don't have murders there.
And at first, Manson was, as you know, not a suspect. We didn't know who did it, but he quickly became one. And he had been to that house before, hadn't he?
I helped the LAPD. I joined in the investigation. Most prosecutors, that's not their job. Their job is to present an evidence, present into evidence, evidence gathered by law enforcement agencies. But I've always... Not lived up, but I never felt restricted by that. And I used to go out into the field myself, and the Manson case was a classic example. And as a result of my investigation, I put Manson inside the gates, the gate of the Tate residence about 4 months before the murders. It had never believed he had ever been there. Not only did I put him inside the gate, but when he knocked on the door, Sharon Tate's photographer, Shayrock Hatami, came to the door, kind of booted him off the premises. But anyway, before that happened, and while Manson was still at the door, poor Sharon came to the door and said, who is it, Hatami? And there's no question that Manson and Sharon must have looked into each other's eyes. And that was about 4 months before he sent his killers there. I do believe that he felt that the Beatles were sending out hidden messages to him and other tuned-in people beneath the lyrics of their songs. For instance, they had a song called Revolution One, and it was in that White Album that came out in December 1968, and Manson came back to the ranch. He was all excited. He used to say that, I'm not going to use the word here, but something is coming down. And then he said, the Beatles are telling it like it is, Helter Skelter is coming down. He substituted the word Helter Skelter for this other word. I don't even think you see things like this, Jim, in horror movies. Young people, teenage girls, early 20s, dressed in black, armed with sharp knives, going into the homes of total strangers in the middle of the night and mercilessly stabbing them to death. I'm not sure they have that in horror movies. It's just so... it's so freaky. One thing that a lot of people have forgotten, or maybe they never knew, I asked for the death penalty against these people. And I told the jury, if this is not a proper case for the imposition of the death penalty, no case ever would be. I also challenged them and said, if they were unwilling to come back with a verdict of death in this case, then we should abolish the death penalty in the state of California. I mean, why have it on the book if this is not a proper case? And the thing that some people have forgotten is that the jury did return verdicts of death against all of these killers, Manson and his co-defendants. And I'll tell you about a conversation I had with Manson. I told him at the beginning of the trial, I said, Charlie, I said, I'm going to convict you, but after you get a fair trial. At the end of the trial, the jury wasn't there at all, but there were a lot of people in the courtroom, and he and I were talking, and he said that I gave him a fair trial. And we used to have kind of sarcastic conversations, and he said to me, you know, Bugliosi, you think you've accomplished a lot, but all you've done is send me back to where I came from. And that was true to a certain extent. When he got out of prison at the age of 32, Jim, 17 out of those 32 years had been spent in jails, reformatories, and prisons. So he was totally institutionalized. And I made a sarcastic remark to him, yeah, Charlie, but as far as I know, you haven't been in the green room before. The green room is the Apple Green Room at San Quentin, where they have the gas chamber, and he just smiled, although he claims to have been resurrected. In any event, a year later, I'm in my car radio on, and I hear the U.S. Supreme Court, Furman versus Georgia, ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional, not per se, but the way it was being implemented by the states. They made their ruling retroactive. Everyone on death row around the country, there were a little over 600 people, including the Manson and his co-defendants. All of their death penalty sentences, Jim, were irreversibly reduced from death down to life. In any event, the first thought that came into my mind when I heard that, I said, you know, what he told me is right. All I've done is send him back to where he came from. And I hate to say it, but I have to be candid. In a sense, Manson has beaten the rap. He's beaten the rap because he doesn't mind prison life. Well, he learned to like life on the outside a little better with his harem of girls and riding dune buggies up and down the desert. But he's totally institutionalized. He's got his guitar. Did you know, Jim, that he recorded behind bars? I don't know how he pulled it off. Two musical albums. He gets more letters than any other inmate, according to the LA Times, and U.S. prison history. He's been selling a lock of his hair for $500. He gets his three meals a day in medical care.
Was he always a monster?
One thing is very, very obvious, even back then. He had a tremendous hostility towards society. And I don't think there's any question that he used his minions, his followers, to vent his spleen for him on society. One reason he hated society, well, I'll give you two quick ones. One, there's no question he had a deprived youth. Other reason, of course, that he had this hostility, he used to look up the Beatles. He thought they were prophets, but he said, if I'm given a chance, I can do better than they did. He wanted to be a recording star. And Terry Melcher was a record producer. Came out to Spahn Ranch to audition Manson, wasn't very impressed, gave him $50 and left. And that's why he went back to the Tate residence looking for Melcher, and he was told that Melcher no longer lived there, but he wanted to prevail upon Melcher again. So he was turned down by the establishment, and he had a tremendous hatred for them. It's funny, I've had people say, well, you know, Mr. Bugliosi, if he had gotten his recording contract, these murders would never have happened. And I think they're right, actually. But I've responded that if someone had bought Hitler's paintings in Vienna in 1913, maybe we wouldn't have had the Second World War, you know, that but-for type of causation.
How did these young people fall sway to his influence?
Boy, you ask good questions, Jim. You're up to your old tricks, asking tough questions that are tough to answer. How did they fall sway to him? Well, for one thing, Jim, you have to realize that Manson had the raw material to work with. Just like water seeks its own level, each group tends to seek its own kind. Every member of Manson's family, before they met him, had already dropped out of society. Most of them had been involved very heavily in the use of psychedelic drugs. So he had the raw material to work with. With that raw material, Jim, I'll try to summarize, because you're asking tough questions that cannot be answered in a couple words. Well, one of the first things he did, Jim, to get control of them, he tried to subvert their sexuality. A new girl joining the family, he would induce her to have sex with another girl, boy with a boy, and it was pretty obvious what he was trying to do. He was trying to remove their ego and their pride. When they had sex orgies, he orchestrated like a maestro. They say when you're on an LSD trip, you're much more vulnerable and susceptible to the influence of third parties. And Manson went on many LSD trips with his family, 2, 3, 4, 5 a week, very cleverly. Either he took no LSD himself or a smaller dosage of LSD than they did, so he could retain more control over his mental faculties. And while they were on these trips, he would dig down very deeply into their psyche and try to remove many of their longstanding convictions on life. Most of the preaching would take place at night when they would have their vegetarian dinner around the campfire. Manson would sit alone on top of a big rock, play his guitar, philosophize on life. No one else, they were all in a circle around him. No one else would talk unless he spoke to them first. But in answer to your question, I would say the three main techniques he used to gain control was to subvert their sexuality, drugs, and preaching to them on a day-to-day basis. He said, listen, these people you're killing, don't look upon them as being decent human beings. Look upon them as being symbols of a sick society that can only be cured by a violent revolution. The ability he seemed to have, Jim, to immediately discern in other people what they wanted to see in him, and then put on a separate face for each person. By his own admission, he said, I am a man of 1,000 faces. He's constantly changing to fit the occasion or the person to whom he was talking. In his ability to detect weaknesses and fears in people and exploit those weaknesses and fears, I'd have to call him a genius.
Charlie Manson died November 19, 2017, 7 days after his 83rd birthday. He actually outlived Vincent Bugliosi, who died a year earlier. But Charlie Manson left a mark on our society that is indelible. And thanks to Vincent Bugliosi through the years for joining us and for telling this story, which warrants a retelling every now and then on this 50th anniversary. Americans who were alive in 1969 still remember that summer, and one of the most vivid parts of it was the death of Sharon Tate and four other people killed by the Charles Manson family. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned.